Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Our topic today, first up at least, is Israel. What is happening on the ground in Gaza? What is happening in the north of Israel? What is happening in the Red Sea? What is happening in Tehran, Iraq, and Jordan, and so much more? And what it all means for us here in the United States, not simply as I believe we should be, very, very important friends of Israel, but also out of self-interest. We need to know what the Biden administration in particular is doing that may well imperil not simply the Jewish state, but our own in due course. To talk about all of this, I am privileged to say I have a great friend as well as a valued colleague at our Center for Security Policy, about which I always encourage you to learn more at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He runs the Middle East program for our center. He has a wealth of experience in government, in the United States Navy as an intelligence officer, rising through the ranks to lieutenant commander. He has been, in addition, an aide and advisor to, among others, an undersecretary of state, a national security advisor, and the vice president of the United States. He is one of our go-to guys on all of these topics, and I couldn't be more pleased that he's able to be with us for an extended conversation. David, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
It's great to be with you, Frank.
Thank you. We're going to talk about some rather tempestuous developments, I think it's fair to say. We don't know the full import of them just yet. We're not even sure we understand the full outlines of them, I think it's fair to say. But one of the things I value so much about you, David, is your instincts are very good, as well as your sources of information and your ability to synthesize what is known and interpret what it likely means is, as the French say, non pareil, that is to say, without equal. Thank you for bringing all that to bear, especially with respect to news of the day, which is that Israel has decided to withdraw virtually all of its forces from the Gaza Strip, leaving one battalion in place. I guess it's fair to say, leaving Hamas in place, certainly in Rafah, and perhaps in other parts of that area as well. What's going on, David?
Yeah, it is a bit of a confusing circumstance, but from what I can gather, at the end of the day, the Israelis are reacting to an American condition. Namely, the United States at this point has reached, I'd say, the edge of collapse of its position, of its paradigm, of its understanding of the region. And when people are reaching such a moment of collapse, they often panic, they act irrationally, they do whatever they can to save to not come to terms with the new reality. And the Israelis are reading this, and I think they're terrified. I think they're terrified of the damage that America can do now to it. Because as a friend of the United States, when people are desperate, they often lean on their friends the worst. And that's exactly where Israel is. They feel that because it's being reasonable, the Americans will come back to them, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what you're seeing here is an Israeli move vis-a-vis not only Gaza, but Iran to essentially get out of the way, clear the deck, and then wait for the collapse so that they can circle back and finish the job. It's an awfully dark way of looking at it, but reasonably what that means is the Americans are focused most on two things. The first is the ceasefire and the hostage negotiations, which the hostages don't seem to matter that much to the administration. It's really the ceasefire that matters.
Even the American hostages.
Right, and they know that the Israelis won't can't ultimately agree to a ceasefire without hostages. So they're willing, they know they have to deal with the hostages. But I don't think that's the end game for the American Biden team. I think it's the ceasefire. The problem is, it's not Israel that's saying no. Israel keeps conceding. It's Hamas who says no, because Hamas sees victory. They see weakness on the American part. They see manipulative capacity. So essentially, the Israelis are seeing themselves and America reach two totally different places. The Israelis see the reality of Hamas getting tougher, saying no, and no reality of a ceasefire coming. And the Americans are desperate for a ceasefire. So I think what's happened here is the Israelis essentially have given the keys to the store to the United States and said, look, you think you can do this? Go ahead, do this. I think the Israelis are reasonably confident, reading the situation, that this is not going to work and the United States will face its own collapse. But Israel then is not held to account for it.
Well, let's tease that out, David, because this is a theory that is, I'm sure, going to be controversial.
Yeah.
It does, I think, accurately describe the chaos that we've witnessed in the Biden team for now some time. Before we go there, though, David, I just want to say, and we'll have to take a break here in a moment, I've thought from basically the beginning of this administration, and I think you have too, we've talked about these issues from that time till now, that the Biden administration's policies towards the Middle East were not only so radically different from those of Donald Trump as to be really almost night and day, but assuredly were going to result in a war. And I feared that the war would be a regional war, unlike anything we've seen, arguably, in history, with quite possibly the use of nuclear weapons in the mix. As generally is the case with my predictions, I prayed that I'd be wrong. But I think what's eventuating here is a war, not just in Gaza, obviously, but as you and others have been observing throughout the region, really, and quite possibly now or in the near future, involving Iran as well. And, you know, I'm mindful of an analogy as you were speaking of the fellow who goes in to save a drowning person, only to discover that the drowning person is so desperate to keep his own head above water that he pushes the rescuer under, and perhaps mortally so. The United States is incoherent at best on what it wants to have come out of this, it seems. And at worst, it is truly prepared to drown Israel in the process. Would you say that's...
I think that's accurate. I think there are... there are really two parts of the administration. One is, I would say, the standard naive or not or somewhat deluded foreign policy establishment. And then there's the second crowd, which I think wants that to happen. They want it to be fatal for Israel. They want it to be fatal for the United States. And when you look at some...
And you're saying there are people inside the Biden administration who believe that way?
I believe there are. I mean, when you look at people like Meir Bitar and so forth, who were but BDS movement, Students for Justice in Palestine, UNRWA officers, they don't want Israel. These are organizations that were dedicated to Israel, were mobilized by Hamas and the PLO to destroy Israel. And in their heyday of trying to destroy Israel, people like Meir Bitar joined them. So,
well, arguably their heyday is today, but certainly in the past, their moment in the sun. But David, we have to take a break. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Since the Nazis killed 6 million Jews, we have promised never again. Today, thanks to Joe Biden's intensifying betrayal of the modern Jewish state, again is now a distinct possibility. In fact, after Israel was genocidally attacked on October 7th, the Biden administration has combined professions of commitment to her survival and arms resupply with a series of initiatives that have encouraged, enabled, and emboldened her enemies and ours to believe they can achieve their stated goal of destroying the Jews and their nation. These include acting to save Hamas, fund its sponsor, Iran, create what would inevitably be a new Palestinian terror state, and decapitate Israel's democratically elected government. A new poll reveals that by a margin of 79% to 21%, American voters support Israel. So Joe Biden is not only betraying our Jewish ally, he's betraying us again. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We're visiting with David Wormser, my colleague and very dear friend at the Center for Security Policy, one of the go-to men, I believe, not just for obviously our team, but official Washington and certainly others around the world on what American policy is and should be vis-a-vis the Middle East. David, we were talking about the United States' policy towards Israel being somewhat schizophrenic, perhaps, but certainly now not just incompetent, but malfeasant. And that may have something to do with the fact that there are people inside the Biden team who would be very happy to see Israel destroyed. I wanted you to talk a little bit about this idea that if Israel basically pulls out of Gaza, and leaves the vacuum to be filled by the United States and presumably Hamas, I guess, on the theory that it will pretty quickly become apparent that there's no good that will come out of all of that, that this will somehow clear the decks for Israel to go back in and finish the job in Rafah and more generally. Have I characterized your thought on that correctly? And if so, tease out how that works in practice, if at all.
Yeah, I think you're accurate in both in what I said and what I think is actually going to happen. I think what happens is that the ceasefire talks don't work. That the United States thinks that if it just gives enough to Hamas, they'll sign a ceasefire. But Hamas sees weakness, and they're hardening their demands. And in the end, they'll keep the hostages, or at least half the hostages, at which point there is no deal. The second thing is Hamas will use any territory to regroup, reorganize. And we already saw it this morning. Six missiles were shot from Khan Yunis, literally from neighborhoods Israel evacuated yesterday, from Khan Yunis onto Israel. That's as many missiles as been shot from Khan Yunis in one day as had been shot since January. So you're going to start seeing the reconstitution of Hamas's missile capabilities and terrorist capabilities against the IDF and Israeli settlements around the borders of Gaza. But also,
so in other words, David, are you saying that the effect of what is happening now, the Israeli withdrawal, notably, has been to ensure that under all circumstances going forward, there will be a very high price paid by the Israelis, either in Israel itself with more attacks coming, maybe just missiles, maybe something else. But
yeah,
also when they have to go back in, as they inevitably will, there will be a higher price because they will be dealing with an enemy that is regrouped and presumably enhanced its capability to fight.
Regrouped and got back 1,000 to 2,000 of their most important terrorists in the process, yeah. And the Israeli military today or yesterday said, the chief of staff said, well, the IDF knows how to deal with the high price that a deal would entail. Problem is they said that after Gilad Shalit, the deal a decade ago to release one soldier for 1,000 plus terrorists. And a lot of the terrorists that were released were the instrumental actors in launching October 7th. So the IDF saying that they can handle the cost is not inspiring. And in general, I'm afraid that this shows that some of the imagery of pre-October 7th continues to thrive at the top of the Israeli military, that they're so strong they can handle it. And I think at this point, the Israelis should abandon that idea and use their strength.
Well, let's turn, if we can, David, to another example of how that theory is being, I think, put to the lie, namely in northern Israel, where, by some estimates, 100,000 Israelis have been displaced because they live too close to another Sharia supremacist terrorist organization, Hezbollah, which is engaged in, I was listening to a podcast with our friend Daniel Horowitz and Yoram Hazani yesterday, and it was recorded earlier in the week, but he was talking about how there's a hot war going on there now. It's not just skirmishing. It is, if it weren't for, you know, Gaza being underway, it would be regarded as a very, very hot conflict up there. So talk us through, I mean, how does the kind of disengagement that Israel is undertaking now in the south, in Gaza, likely to play with respect to the north?
Yeah, I think, and you know, you're beginning to link them, and I think that's exactly correct. What's happening here is, first of all, Yoram is right. There's about anywhere between 50 and 100 missiles being shot from Lebanon into Israel daily. And they're becoming increasingly dangerous. And there are casualties on the Israeli side. And then the worst thing is, of course, there's 100,000 or so, I don't know, 50 to 100,000 Israelis who can't live in the north, and they've been removed to the center, in addition to the 30 to 50,000 still displaced from the south. And the problem there, too, is that that means there's no Jews in the Galilee, living in the Galilee right now. The Arab towns are a little further south and therefore have not been evacuated. There are a few around the border that have, but not further south. So what's happening here is literally Israel has demographically in one swoop lost the Galilee. And that's part of the strategy that Hamas, Hezbollah is doing, is to take the war to Israel and slowly eat away at Israeli territory. And then all of a sudden you've got another West Bank, but this time it's in the Galilee. Where it's coming together is the Israelis are responding, and quite effectively. They're killing top levels of Hezbollah, but more importantly, the Israelis are taking the war to the Iranians who are present. And they are not hesitating the way the United States did. They are seeking out senior Iranian officials and killing them. And the biggest example of it was a few days ago, where they killed seven IRGC officials, five of which were generals, two of which had been serving in the National Security Council of Iran. Very serious senior. And of course, that led to a second crisis, which Iran...
I did want to ask, before we go there, David, has Israel now acknowledged that it launched that attack, or is that still left somewhat
shadowy? I don't
think
it said the words, "we did it," but they have said the words of, they have described the target in such a way to make it clear that they intentionally did that. They've said it wasn't the diplomatic council, it was a building that was rented, that was an annex and didn't have consular status, et cetera, which means if they're saying that, they're trying to justify their action.
Right. And one other justification for the action, of course, is, as you know, David, was that apparently the top of those five generals was the guy who actually personally helped engineer the October 7th invasion by Hamas. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, it's not only my understanding, it's what the Iranians are crowing about, that they admitted this organization, Shana, which is sort of an organization of senior IRGC officials, is quite proud of the role that this brigadier general played in organizing October 7th, which of course belies the whole idea that they weren't involved, and again exposes the American position, which is that Iran really doesn't control its proxies, to be diluted.
Right. This is going to bring us to a conversation about Iran and all of this, and how Iran's role and the Biden administration's determination, I guess, to appease Iran at every turn is now playing into some of the machinations of the U.S. administration, both in Gaza and vis-a-vis the war throughout the region. David Wormser is with us. We're going to continue this conversation. I hope you will stay with us as well. I'll be right back right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. David Wormser is in the house, I'm pleased to say. We're talking with him about this very, I believe, fraught decision of the Israeli government to withdraw essentially all of its forces from Gaza and some of the repercussions that are already being felt in terms of, among other things, renewed missile attacks from areas that had just recently been occupied by Israel and are no longer in that mode. And David, I did want to come back to Gaza for one more moment before we turn fully to Iran. One of the things that has been a pretext for what appears to be very insistent pressure on Israel by the Biden administration to do what it's done, which is to essentially disengage from Hamas in the furtherance of a ceasefire, presumably, but at the very least to forego an attack on Rafah, the last stronghold, we're told, of Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And the impetus for this most immediately was the tragic loss of life on the part of members of this so-called World Central Kitchen Group, providing humanitarian relief. There's been a report, and I wanted to run it by you as to whether you credit it, what the Israeli military has said was their mistake, an honest mistake of the kind that does happen in times of war, of course, might not have actually been so much their mistake as a result of a ploy, basically, that Hamas engineered, whereby the Israelis lost track of the shell under which the peanut was Talk a little bit about what we know about the incident and what we're learning about who may actually have brought it to this pass, where it has brought the world's wrath down on Israel, including that of the Biden administration.
Yeah, I actually think the incident didn't bring the wrath down. I think the wrath was there, and the incident was seized as an opportunity by Israel's allies. It's really quite a dishonorable circumstance that Israel's allies were just waiting to pounce on Israel. And inevitably in war, there's going to be a mistake. And this was one of them. But what is coming out as we're going along here is more and more reports are emerging, none of which are being denied by the IDF, many of which are from credible news sources that are basing it on the IDF report, that there were terrorists who were hitchhiking on this convoy. And that's where the confusion led, is that the Israelis knew that there had been a terrorist on that convoy. They didn't know which car it was in. Apparently, they lost track. Like you said, it was a shell game. Which shell is it under? But what's more is there's sort of an admission, even by the Israeli army, who punished and threw out two incredibly impressive officers. It's quite sad. Two incredibly impressive officers. Over this, there's an admission by the Israeli military that, yeah, well, you know, all these convoys, though, have terrorists that hitchhike on them and so forth. So I'm sort of denying that, you know, they should have known better. They're actually confirming something we know, we suspect, which is every single act of humanitarian assistance is being used by Hamas, hijacked by Hamas, either to provide logistical cover for Hamas, or ultimately that they still control the humanitarian distribution, in which case the humanitarian crisis is a deliberately engineered strategic move. So this incident went the
that,
more
that helps prop up Hamas.
That helps prop up Hamas and lead and put pressure on Israel. So what we're seeing is the more you peel away this accident, the more you're beginning to see all these cockroaches emerge from underneath. That everybody's just living with.
Just one example of the reporting that I saw, David, in terms of the hijacking or hitchhiking, whatever you want to call it, by Hamas terrorists was somebody used a rifle to fire into the air as the convoy was moving along at one point, drawing attention, obviously, of the Israelis to the convoy and making it look as though it had hostiles aboard, as indeed it did, apparently. And then it went into, I'm told, a hangar of some kind, a warehouse, whatever, and lingered there for an hour and then emerged. And in the meantime, presumably had further confused the Israelis as to who was where and who what was in the cars.
Yeah, I mean, we heard that the convoy was coordinating with Israel, which it does at most of the points of it, but it also apparently coordinated with Hamas. When the Hamas guys shoot in the air, it's a communication device to say where they are, because they obviously have lost most communication. So they signal that they're where they're supposed to be and shoot in the air as a sort of like a flare would be in a lot of other circumstances. So that's the nature of that.
David, this is so distressing on so many different levels, because it's revealing about the kind of environment Israel has been struggling in, and the cynicism as well as the inhumanity of the people that it's up against, who, as we've discussed, I consider to be not just using human shields, but using human weapons for the purposes of trying to defeat the Israelis. And today's developments, you know, just further evidence that it's working. Let's come back to Iran, which is obviously the chief player in all of this, Hamas and Hezbollah, and we haven't even gotten to the Houthis. But one of the other pretexts for the Biden administration seemingly very insistently telling Israel it has to cease and desist, if not in a formal ceasefire, in some other manner to change its policy, as Tony Blinken famously put it, so as to avoid the U.S. government changing its policy, namely to stop or at least strictly limit the amount of resupply of arms going to Israel. Was this attack on the Iranian building in a diplomatic compound in Damascus that took down a chunk of the frontline leadership of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps? And to the extent that we now know that they were legitimate targets, and the Israelis, I gather, have contended that they were not actually in a diplomatic building with diplomatic status. The question is, what precipitated the American action was probably the Iranians professing that they were going to launch direct attacks against Israel, widening the war and ending the notions that the administration cherished of Iran being a positive actor in the region as its hegemon. Walk us through this quickly, David, if you can.
This is a good example where there was a convergence between America panicking and using its own panic. Iran threatened Israel. It's put all these missile videos on TV. They're going to strike Tel Aviv. They're going to do this, et cetera, et cetera. But all the Iran watchers,
mobilizing those missiles, mobilizing, I think,
but all the Iran watchers that I know, including myself, know that Iran rarely strikes from its own territory. It likes to use others. We saw it as a fairly low probability they would strike from Iran onto Israel. So the CIA puts out this report, this dramatic report, with 100% certainty within 48 to 72 hours, Iran is going to strike Israel from Iran, and oh, the world will end. A genuinely apocalyptic report that is completely at odds with the reality we see on the ground with Iran. So I have a feeling what happened was the Iranians were willing to cash in on that. They realized they have Americans in a panic. So they said, listen, okay, you know, you get the Israelis to stop in Gaza. You get a ceasefire, and you get the Israelis to stand down. Then we won't strike like that. We'll take our time and strike somewhere else later, or an embassy, but we won't do it tomorrow. And the United States, both panicking and seeing this as useful, then turned to the Israelis and said, listen, we got to avoid this. This is all about to explode in an apocalyptic orgy. And then you just have to stop. So that's, I think, the backdrop to why the Israelis basically scratched their heads and said they didn't understand if Iran strikes with missiles against Israel, it can expose Iranian weakness. Those missiles will be shot down by the Arrow system. Iran doesn't have good options against Israel. Israel has escalatory dominance. So the Israelis were not that moved, but the Americans were panicking. So I think that also is part of the overall irrationality that has set in on American policy. And the Iranians played this beautifully, and the Israelis really had no choice but to say, okay, listen, you and America got it all wrong, but we have to play along with you. You're our ally, and we have no choice at this point. So, but this is all a reality that will collapse. This, as you said at the beginning, these sorts of actions lead to war. We're in a war. This is going to lead to a much bigger war.
And obviously longer, more costly, as well as longer war.
It will cost America its position in the region.
Well, it may cost us a lot more than that, David. We're going to talk about that on the other side of this next break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned, folks, for more with Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy, right after this. Thank you. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Since the Nazis killed 6 million Jews, we have promised never again. Today, thanks to Joe Biden's intensifying betrayal of the modern Jewish state, again is now a distinct possibility. In fact, after Israel was genocidally attacked on October 7th, the Biden administration has combined professions of commitment to her survival and arms resupply with a series of initiatives that have encouraged, enabled, and emboldened her enemies and ours to believe they can achieve their stated goal of destroying the Jews and their nation. These include acting to save Hamas, fund its sponsor, Iran, create what would inevitably be a new Palestinian terror state, and decapitate Israel's democratically elected government. A new poll reveals that by a margin of 79% to 21%, American voters support Israel. So Joe Biden is not only betraying our Jewish ally, he's betraying us again. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, I wanted to level set with you a little bit. We're speaking with Dr. David Wormser, our duty expert on the Middle East at the Center for Security Policy. I want to, as always, encourage you folks to join us at the center. Take stock of the great work that David and others do there, the research, the analysis, the coalitions that we sponsor. And join us most especially by supporting that work, if you can, at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. But David, we started the show by talking about this decision by the Israelis to essentially disengage from Gaza. There is a corridor that is going to be continuing to have Israel a battalion's worth of Israelis present there. We're told by Benjamin Netanyahu that this disengagement is just a temporary repositioning to allow those who've been engaged in combat for a protracted period of time now to rest, to recover, to regroup. Unfortunately, of course, it is allowing Israel's enemies and ours in Hamas to do the same. And what we've been doing is we've been looking around the region, not just at Gaza, but also at Lebanon and Hezbollah there and Syria and Iran there. And I did want to talk with you a little bit about a couple of other places that are seemingly increasingly, in play as we take stock on what is happening. I did want to just contest, maybe clarify at least. I'm not sure that the Iranians are without strategic leverage on Israel. It may be that their missiles launched from Iran are not so much, but all of these things, all of these proxies and things that they're now trying to engineer in terms of other problems in the region seem to me to be creating a fairly big strategic challenge for the Israelis. But talk, if you would, a little bit, David, about the Golan Heights, what's happening there. You mentioned the Galilee. In mm-hmm. the past, when enemies were on the Golan Heights, Galilee was, you know, incessantly being attacked, as it is now, I guess, from Lebanon. Israeli forces on the Golan was for many, many years a hedge against that kind of thing happening again. What's the state of play up there, David? Iranians and Palestinians and others mm-hmm. activity on the heights above the Galilee?
Well, some of the missiles being sent into the Galilee, there are also missiles being fired onto the Golan Heights, specifically the Israeli intelligence.
From Syria or from Lebanon?
Yes. Yes and yes. And the Israelis have responded. And also, by the way, from Iraq. There are suicide drones being shot from Iraq into the both into the Galilee and into and into the Golan, by the way, also down to the south toward Eilat. The missile that hit Eilat a few days ago came from Iraq.
Yeah. A naval facility there, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing. Iran has regional proxies, which are leverage. The Israelis are sort of sitting on their hands and responding because the United States is terrified of a regional war. And that is, of course, the strategic leverage of Iran, which is the United States' fear. Where if that fear is broken or the Israelis act anyway, that's where the Iranians begin to run into trouble. Because if Israel begins to really win against Hezbollah and win against Iran's proxies in Iraq and in Yemen, then what begins to happen is all the other strategic threats that Iran is doing, which are based more on perception and regional following. For example, the unrest in Jordan. Iran is trying to overthrow the government of Jordan. To do so, though, Iran has to be seen by the Jordanians as the strategic winner, that it's the horse to bet on. And that's feeding the uprising, the violence in Jordan. Similarly, whereas the United States thought that, oh, we'll build up the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army is just an extension of Hezbollah. So the more Iran wins, or the more Iran is perceived as being in control, the weaker the Western position is in Lebanon, the more besieged the Christian community is, and the Sunni community, and the Druze community, etc., and the more Hezbollah has its grip on Lebanon. So ironically, the fear we have of an escalation and restraining Israel is precisely leading to the escalation and the strategic advance and momentum on behalf of Iran. And that's why the way to solve this would be to escalate against Iran and to show them as weak and vulnerable. But that's the despair the United States has. That's such a collapse of its paradigm that it's the analogy of the drowning person. Rather than realize that he should grab the wood and calm down, he is still flailing in any direction, grabbing anything he can and drowning anybody around him that he can.
Right. David, this is such a chilling picture that you're painting. You mentioned something, though, that I want to particularly ask you to illuminate. The turmoil or ferment in Jordan is, as I understand it, taking the form of these protests outside the Israeli embassy, decrying what's happening in Gaza and so on. But is that further metastasizing now as hostility towards the regime in Jordan as well?
Yeah, those are daily and they're getting bigger, but it's not the only thing. Israel faced 2 days ago an attack across the Jordanian border by terrorists, a very dangerous one. And the terrorists did manage to flee back into Jordan. So the border there is becoming like the Gaza border was, where there are independent actors now operating in Jordan. The Iraqi militias are demanding to be allowed through Jordan onto the Israeli border. For the moment, the Jordanian government is saying no, but at the end of the day, they're anyway crossing, and that's probably the terrorist that was part of the Iraqi militia, most likely. So Jordan is beginning to crumble and fall, and we could spend an hour on it, but the king of Jordan has made terrible mistakes similar to those of the United States. He thought he could feed the tiger. He thought he could appease the rage.
It inevitably winds up eating you in the process. David, we have to take a final break. We'll be right back with more tying all of this together with the great David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy. I hope you'll stay tuned for that and more. Straight ahead. We're back. David Wormser is with us for one final installment of this very important sort of tour d'horizon of his portfolio, what's happening in the Middle East. Very, very little of it good, my friends, I'm sorry to say. David, we were talking about Jordan, we were talking about Iraq, getting into Jordan and further, I'm sure, compounding the problems for the government there. Further ferment is, of course, happening elsewhere on the Arabian Peninsula, with implications for many of our remaining friends, such as they are in that region. Notably with the murder that the Houthi rebels, another Iranian proxy in Yemen, are getting away with, more or less. If not literally, not for want of trying, but certainly figuratively, in the sense of really garroting shipping, particularly Israeli shipping, that would otherwise be going into the Red Sea and up through the Suez Canal, perhaps, or to Eilat or whatever. But give us a quick burst on what's going on with the Houthis.
Well, the Houthis are doing two things. One is this, they're still stopping all the shipping, and two, they're still shooting missiles and long-range drones at Israel.
Stopping the shipping, I think the Chinese shipping is continuing, is it not?
Well, this is the thing, is that there are countries that have cut deals with Yemen, probably strategically coordinated with Yemen would be a better way to put it, to essentially turn this vital waterway into a Russian-Chinese waterway. So if you're coordinating with China and your allies with China and serving the strategic interests of China, then you have an in with the Houthis and with the Chinese who will protect you going through. So this has become not only an attack on Israel, but it's become essentially a termination of America's role as the master of the seas in that area, which is
the guarantor of freedom of navigation. Yeah,
and which is the destruction of the 2.25 century policy.
As you're talking, I've gotten in my mind the clearest evidence to date of the weaponization of the Belt and Road Initiative, and whether that's a literal phenomenon in this particular case or whether it's just where this is all headed. This will not be the last part of the world that will be off limits, I suspect, to those friendly to the United States and its own, shipping and forces, of course. That's part of this sort of global colonial build-out of the Chinese Communist Party. Mm-hmm. But David, I wanted to pivot finally to another part of this very dynamic portfolio of yours, and that is the West Bank, the so-called West Bank, the traditional historic Judea and Samaria. There are Israeli settlers who live in those areas, the disputed territories, others call them the occupied territories. The United States has been actively propping up the Palestinian Authority there, notably by training security forces. What's the state of play there, and how does that fit into the larger game that Ron is up to, do you think?
Yeah, well, I you know, this is really the most dangerous part of it for Israel, which is the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, which is a huge bulge in the center of Israel, from which, within about 5 kilometers from that line, from those lines, about 80% of Israel lives. So this is the heartland of Israel. It would be as if there were territory given up that we're 5 kilometers from New York, Philadelphia, Washington, L.A., and San Francisco and Chicago and all the cities in Texas, all the major population centers, 80% of Israel's population is within 5 kilometers of this. You overlay what happened on October 7th, you get the picture. You would have had hundreds of thousands of Israelis killed, thousands and thousands of hostages. Israel probably wouldn't have survived. Now what's happening? The United States, the Palestinian Authority, has no currency among Palestinians. It's a weak body that exists, ironically, because the Israeli army props it up and defends it, and the United States fuels it and funds it. And they're trying to still maintain the fiction of, oh, if we had better training, et cetera, but they're rejected. They're not. A few factions of the government, Fatah factions, are actually popular now, but it's because they've joined with Hamas to attack Israel. What we're finding is a very disturbing phenomenon is these highly trained officials and senior security officials in the Palestinian Authority are the ones conducting the terrorist attacks over the last week or two. And they're the ones who are so well trained by the United States that the Israelis are having a devil of a time. The attacks happen. They know how to hide. The Israelis are capturing them so far. But it takes a day. More people get killed during that process. This is very dangerous.
And when you say the terrorist attacks, you're talking now about in the
West
Judea,
Bank,
Samaria, West Bank area.
In the West Bank or on the roads in Israel from the West Bank. So this is not connected to Gaza anymore. This is in the West Bank. And moreover, we see the training videos of the Palestinian Authority training to do an October 7th type attack against Israel. So, and they praised October 7th and they think it's good. So Israel's facing in the West Bank exactly what it faced with Hamas in Gaza, but with the Palestinian Authority.
With the Palestinian Authority and security forces that have not only been trained but armed by the United States. And I've heard settlers say that they're terrified that the kind of capabilities that the Palestinians out of Gaza were able to bring to bear against essentially defenseless populations in the kibbutz and so on adjacent to Gaza will, you know, pale by comparison with the kinds of threats that these forces, as I say, both trained and equipped by our best people, are going to be able to bring to bear against relatively insecure settlers. But also, David, you're talking about Israel itself as well. Look, again, folks, I just hate to say that this was what I feared might come of the Biden administration's determination to empower and embolden Iran and weaken Israel from its earliest days in office. It's anybody's guess where this is going to end. David, I know you will be tracking closely the developments day in and day out. We look forward to visiting with you with trepidation, I have to say, but with great admiration as well. And thank you for the great work you do. I know you'll keep it up at the Center for Security Policy, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. I hope the rest of you will come back to us next time. Until then, you'll help us at the center, yes, but go forth and multiply.